told him if he returned, he'd be shot. "I'll die out here alone," he said, sobbing, and no one disagreed. But what else could they do? "Why has no one come here?" Dolores asked. "That's what I keep wondering. I don't mean rescue. I just mean people wandering in." The airport wasn't especially remote. Severn City was no more than 20 miles away. No one walked in, but, on the other hand, who was left? Early reports had put the mortality rate at 99%. "And then one has to account for societal collapse," Garrett said. "There might be no one left." He was a businessman from the east coast of Canada. He'd been wearing the same suit since his flight had landed, except now he was pairing it with a beautiful Northern Michigan t-shirt from the gift shop. He was bright-eyed in a way that Clark found disconcerting. "The violence, maybe cholera and typhoid, all the infections that were cured by antibiotics back when it was possible to obtain antibiotics, and then things like bee stings, asthma. Does anyone have a cigarette?" "You're funny," Annette said. She'd run out of nicotine patches on day 4. During a particularly rough stretch a few weeks back, she'd tried to smoke cinnamon from the coffee kiosk. "Was that a no?" "And diabetes," Garrett said, apparently forgetting the cigarette. "HIV, high blood pressure, types of cancer that responded to chemotherapy when chemotherapy was available." "No more chemotherapy," Annette said. "I've thought of that too." "Everything happens for a reason," Tyler said. Clark hadn't noticed his approach. Tyler had been wandering the airport of late, and he had a way of moving so quietly that he seemed to materialize out of nowhere. He spoke so rarely that it was easy to forget he was there. "That's what my mom said," he added when everyone stared at him.
"Yeah, but that's because Elizabeth's a fucking lunatic," Garrett said.
Clark had noticed that he had a filter problem.
"In front of the kid?"
Annette was twisting her Lufthansa neck scarf between her fingers.
"That's his mother you're talking about. Tyler, don't listen to him."
Tyler only stared at Garrett.
"I'm sorry," Garrett said to Tyler. "I was out of line."
Tyler didn't blink.
"You know," Clark said, "I think we should consider sending out a scouting party."
The scouts left at dawn on day 100. Tyrone, Dolores, and Alan, a schoolteacher from Chicago. There was some debate over whether the scouting party was actually a good idea. They'd been able to kill enough deer to live on, and they had what they needed here, barely, except for soap and batteries, which they'd run out of, and what could possibly be out there except the pandemic. Nonetheless, the scouting party set out armed with Tyrone's TSA handgun and some roadmaps. The silence of day 100, waiting for the scouting party to return with supplies, or return carrying the flu, or return trailing unhinged survivors who wanted to kill everyone, or not return at all. It had snowed the night before, and the world was still. White snow, dark trees, gray sky, the airline logos on the tails of grounded airplanes, the only splashes of color in the landscape. Clark wandered into the Sky Miles lounge. He'd been avoiding it lately because he'd been avoiding Elizabeth, but it was a reliably quiet corner of the airport, and he liked the armchairs with the views over the tarmac. He stood looking out at the line of planes, and for the first time in a while, he found himself thinking of Robert, his boyfriend. Robert was a curator. Had been a curator? Yes, probably Robert existed in the past tense, along with almost everyone else. Try not to think about it. And when Clark turned away from the window, his gaze fell on a glass display case that had once held sandwiches. If Robert were here, Christ, if only, if Robert were here, he'd probably fill the shelves with artifacts and start an impromptu museum. Clark placed his useless iPhone on the top shelf. What else? Max had left on the last flight to Los Angeles, but his Amex card was still gathering dust on the counter of the Concourse B Mexican restaurant. Beside it, Lily Patterson's driver's license.
Clark took these artifacts back to the Sky Miles lounge and laid them side by side under the glass. They looked insubstantial there, so he added his laptop, and this was the beginning of the Museum of Civilization. He mentioned it to no one, but when he came back a few hours later, someone had added another iPhone, a pair of 5-inch red stiletto heels, and a snow globe. Clark had always been fond of beautiful objects, and in his present state of mind, all objects were beautiful. He stood by the case and found himself moved by every object he saw there, by the human enterprise each object had required. Consider the snow globe. Consider the mind that invented those miniature storms, the factory worker who turned sheets of plastic into white flakes of snow, the hand that drew the plan for the miniature Severn City with its church steeple and city hall, the assembly line worker who watched the globe glide past on a conveyor belt somewhere in China. Consider the white gloves on the hands of the woman who inserted the snow globes into boxes to be packed into larger boxes, crates, shipping containers. Consider the card games played below decks in the evenings on the ship carrying the containers across the ocean, a hand stubbing out a cigarette in an overflowing ashtray, a haze of blue smoke in dim light, the cadences of a half dozen languages united by common profanities, the sailors' dreams of land and women, these men for whom the ocean was a gray line horizon to be traversed in ships the size of overturned skyscrapers. Consider the signature on the shipping manifest when the ship reached port, a signature unlike any other on Earth. The coffee cup in the hand of the driver delivering boxes to the distribution center, the secret hopes of the UPS man carrying boxes of snow globes from there to the Severn City Airport. Clark shook the globe and held it up to the light. When he looked through it, the planes were warped and caught in whirling snow. The scouting party returned the next day, exhausted and cold, with 3 steel carts from an industrial kitchen, piled high with supplies. They'd found a Chili's that no one had looted yet, they said, and they'd spent the night shivering in booths. They had toilet paper, Tabasco sauce, napkins, salt and pepper, enormous tins of tomatoes, dinnerware and bags of rice, gallons of pink hand soap. They said that just out of sight along the road there was a roadblock, a sign warning of quarantine. No one had come to the airport because the sign said the flu was here. Sick passengers, keep out. Beyond the roadblock, abandoned cars as far as they could see, some with bodies inside. They'd come upon a hotel near the airport and had debated going in for sheets and towels, but the smell was such that they'd known what was waiting in the darkened lobby and had decided against it. Then the fast food restaurants a little down the road. They'd seen no other people. What was it like out there? Clark asked. It was silent, Dolores said. She'd been surprised by the emotion that had overtaken her on the return, when the scouting party had struggled past the roadblock with their carts of supplies, their napkins, and their clinking bottles of Tabasco sauce, up the airport road, and then the airport had come into view between the trees. Home, she'd thought, and she'd felt such relief. A day later, the first stranger walked in. They'd taken to posting guards with whistles so that they might be warned of a stranger's approach. They'd all seen the post-apocalyptic movies with the dangerous stragglers fighting it out for the last few scraps. Although actually, when she thought about it, Annette said, the post-apocalyptic movies she'd seen had all involved zombies. I'm just saying, she said, it could be much worse. But the first man who walked in under low gray skies seemed less dangerous than stunned. He was dirty, of indeterminate age, dressed in layers of clothes, and he hadn't shaved in a long time. He appeared on the road with a gun in his hand, but he stopped and let the gun fall to the pavement when Tyrone shouted for him to drop it. He raised his hands over his head and stared at the people gathering around him. Everyone had questions. He seemed to struggle for speech. His lips moved silently, and he had to clear his throat several times before he could speak. Clark realized that he hadn't spoken in some time. I was in the hotel, he said finally. I followed your footprints in the snow.
There were tears on his face.
Okay, someone said, but why are you crying?
I'd thought I was the only one, he said.
Chapter 44. By the end of year 15, there were 300 people in the airport, and the Museum of Civilization filled the Sky Miles Lounge. In former times, when the airport had had fewer people, Clark had worked all day at the details of survival, gathering firewood, hauling water to the restrooms to keep the toilets operational, participating in salvage operations in the abandoned town of Severn City, planting crops in the narrow fields along the runways, skinning deer. But there were many more people now, and Clark was older, and no one seemed to mind if he cared for the museum all day. There seemed to be a limitless number of objects in the world that had no practical use, but that people wanted to preserve. Cell phones with their delicate buttons, iPads, Tyler's Nintendo console, a selection of laptops. There were a number of impractical shoes, stilettos mostly, beautiful and strange. There were three car engines in a row, cleaned and polished, a motorcycle composed mostly of gleaming chrome. Traders brought things for Clark sometimes, objects of no real value that they knew he would like, magazines and newspapers, a stamp collection, coins. There were the passports or the driver's licenses or sometimes the credit cards of people who had lived at the airport and then died. Clark kept impeccable records. He kept Elizabeth and Tyler's passports open to the picture pages. Elizabeth had given them to him the night before they'd left, in the summer of year 2. He was still unsettled by the passports, after all these years.
They were unsettling people, Dolores said.
A few months before Elizabeth and Tyler left, back in year 2, Clark was breaking up sticks for kindling when he looked up and thought he saw someone standing by the Air Gradia jet. A child, but there were a number of children in the airport, and he couldn't tell who it was at this distance. The plane was strictly off-limits, but the children liked to scare one another with stories of ghost sightings. The child was holding something. A book? Clark found Tyler standing by the nose of the plane, reading aloud from a paperback. "Therefore, in one day her plagues will overtake her," he said to the plane as Clark approached. He paused and looked up. Do you hear that? Plagues. One day her plagues will overtake her. Death, mourning, and famine. She will be consumed by fire, for mighty is the Lord God who judges her. Clark recognized the text. For 3 months in his Toronto days, he'd had a formerly evangelical boyfriend who'd kept a Bible by the bed. Tyler stopped reading and looked up.
You read very well for your age, Clark said.
Thank you.
The boy was obviously a little off, but what could anyone do for him? In year 2, everyone was still reeling.
What were you doing?
I'm reading to the people inside, Tyler said.
There's no one in there.
But of course there was. Clark was chilled in the sunlight. The plane remained sealed, because opening it was a nightmare no one wanted to think about, because no one knew if the virus could be contracted from the dead, because it was as good a mausoleum as any. He'd never been this close to it. The plane's windows were dark.
I just want them to know that it happened for a reason.
Look, Tyler, some things just happen.
This close, the stillness of the ghost plane was overwhelming.
But why did they die instead of us? The boy asked, with an air of patiently reciting a well-rehearsed argument. His gaze was unblinking.
Because they were exposed to a certain virus and we weren't. You can look for reasons, and God knows a few people here have driven themselves half-crazy trying, but Tyler, that's all there is.
What if we were saved for a different reason?
Saved?
Clark was remembering why he didn't talk to Tyler very often.
Some people were saved. People like us.
What do you mean, people like us?
People who were good, Tyler said. People who weren't weak.
Look, it's not a question of having been bad, or the people in there, in the air gradient jet. They were just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Okay, Tyler said.
Clark turned away, and Tyler's voice resumed almost immediately behind him, softer now, reading aloud.
She will be consumed by fire, for mighty is the Lord God who judges her.
Elizabeth and Tyler were living in the first-class cabin of the Air France jet. He found her sitting in the sunlight on the rolling staircase that led up to the entrance, knitting something. He hadn't spoken with her in a while. He hadn't been avoiding her, exactly, but he certainly hadn't sought her company.
"I'm worried about your son," he said.
She paused in her knitting. The manic intensity of her first days here had dissipated.
"Why?"
"Right now, he's over by the quarantined plane," Clark said, reading aloud to the dead from the Book of Revelation.
"Oh."
She smiled and resumed her knitting.
"He's a very advanced reader."
"I think maybe he's picked up some strange ideas about, well, about what happened." He still had no words for it, he realized. No one spoke of it directly.
"What kind of strange ideas?"
"He thinks the pandemic happened for a reason," Clark said.
"It did happen for a reason."
"Well, right. But, I mean, a reason besides the fact that almost everyone on Earth caught an extremely deadly swine flu mutation. He seems to think there was some sort of divine judgment involved."
"He's right," she said.
She stopped knitting for a moment to count her rows. He felt a touch of vertigo.
"Elizabeth, what reason could there possibly be for something like this? What kind of plan would possibly require..."
He realized that his voice had risen. His fists were clenched.
"Everything happens for a reason," she said.
She didn't look at him.
"It's not for us to know."
Later that summer, a band of religious wanderers arrived, headed south. The precise nature of their religion was unclear. "A new world requires new gods," they said. They said, "We are guided by visions." They said vague things about signals and dreams. The airport hosted them for a few uneasy nights, because this seemed less dangerous than running them off. The wanderers ate their food and in return offered blessings, which mostly involved palms on foreheads and muttered prayers. They sat in a circle in Concourse C and chanted at night, in no language anyone in the airport had ever heard. When they left, Elizabeth and Tyler went with them.
"We just want to live a more spiritual life," Elizabeth said, "my son and I."
And she apologized for leaving everyone, as though her leaving was some sort of personal abandonment. Tyler looked very small as they left, trailing at the back of the group.
"I should have done more for her," Clark thought. "I should have pulled her back from the edge." But it had taken everything he had to stay back from the edge himself. And what could he have done?
When the group disappeared around the curve of the airport road, he was certain he wasn't alone in his relief.
"That kind of insanity's contagious," Dolores had said, echoing his thoughts.
In year 15, people came to the museum to look at the past after their long days of work. A few of the original first-class lounge armchairs were still here, and it was possible to sit and read the final newspapers, 15 years old, turning brittle pages in gloves that Clark had sewn inexpertly from a hotel sheet. What happened here was something like prayer. James, the first man who'd walked in, came to the museum almost every day to look at the motorcycle. He'd found it in Severn City in year 2 and had used it until the automobile gas went stale and the aviation gas ran out. He missed it very much. Emmanuel, the first child born in the airport, came in often to look at the phones. There was a school here now, in Concourse C. Like educated children everywhere, the children in the airport school memorized abstractions. The airplanes outside once flew through the air. You could use an airplane to travel to the other side of the world, but the schoolteacher was a man who'd had frequent flyer status on two airlines. When you were on an airplane, you had to turn off your electronic devices before takeoff and landing, devices such as the tiny flat machines that played music and the larger machines that opened up like books and had screens that hadn't always been dark, the insides brimming with circuitry. And these machines were the portals into a worldwide network. Satellites beamed information down to Earth. Goods traveled in ships and airplanes across the world. There was no place on Earth that was too far away to get to. They were told about the Internet, how it was everywhere and connected everything, how it was us. They were shown maps and globes, the lines of the borders that the Internet had transcended. This is the yellow mass of land in the shape of a mitten. This pin here on the wall is Severn City. That was Chicago. That was Detroit. The children understood dots on maps here, but even the teenagers were confused by the lines. There had been countries and borders. It was hard to explain. In the fall of year 15, something remarkable happened. A trader came through with a newspaper. He'd been coming to the airport since year 6, and his specialties were cookware, socks, and sewing supplies. He camped for the night in the Air France jet and came to Clark in the morning before he left.
"I've got something I thought you might like," he said, "for that museum of yours."
And he handed over three sheets of rough paper.
"What is this?"
"It's a newspaper," the trader said.
Three consecutive issues, a few months out of date. It was published irregularly out of New Petoskey, the trader said. There were announcements of births and deaths and weddings, a column for bartering. A local man was seeking new shoes in exchange for milk and eggs. Someone else had a pair of reading glasses that she was hoping to trade for a pair of jeans, size 6. There was a story about a group of three ferals who'd been sighted to the southwest of town, a woman and two children. Residents were urged to avoid them and, in case of accidental contact, to speak gently and avoid making any sudden movements. Something called the Traveling Symphony had just come through town, although Clark gathered that they weren't just a symphony orchestra. There was a rapturous write-up of a performance of King Lear, with particular mention of performances by Gil Harris as Lear and Kirsten Raymond as Cordelia. A local girl wished to announce that she had a litter of kittens to give away and that the kitten's mother was a good mouser. There was a reminder that the library was always seeking books and that they paid in wine. The librarian, Francois Diallo, was also the newspaper's publisher, and it appeared that when he had empty space in the newspaper, he filled it with text from his collection. The first issue had an Emily Dickinson poem, the second an excerpt from a biography of Abraham Lincoln. The entire back of the third issue, it had apparently been a slow month for news and announcements, was taken up by an interview with the actress who'd played Cordelia, Kirsten Raymond. She'd left Toronto with her brother at the time of the collapse, but she only knew this because her brother had told her. Her memories were limited, but there was a night just before the end that she remembered in detail. Raymond. I was on stage with two other girls in the production, and I was behind Arthur, so I didn't see his face. But I remember there was some commotion up front, just in front of the stage. And then I remember hearing a sound, this sharp thwack, and that was Arthur hitting his hand on the plywood pillar by my head. He'd sort of stumbled back, his arm flailed out, and then a man from the audience had climbed up on the stage and was running toward him. Clark stopped breathing for a moment when he read it. The shock of encountering someone who knew Arthur, who had not only known him, but had seen him die. The newspapers were passed hand to hand around the airport for 4 days. They were the first new newspapers anyone had seen since the collapse. When the papers were returned to the museum, Clark held them in his hands for a long while, reading the interview with the actress again. The mention of Arthur aside, he realized this was an extraordinary development. If there were newspapers now, what else might be possible? In the old days, he'd taken quite a few red-eye flights from New York to Los Angeles, and there was a moment in the flight when the rising sunlight spread from east to west over the landscape, dawn reflected in rivers and lakes 30,000 feet below his window, and although, of course, he knew it was all a matter of time zones, that it was always night and always morning somewhere on Earth, in those moments he'd harbored a secret pleasure in the thought that the world was waking up. He hoped for more newspapers in the years that followed, but none came. Chapter 45. The interview in year 15 continued. Raymond, do you have any more questions?
Diallo, I do have more questions, but you didn't want to answer them.
Raymond, I'll answer if you don't record me. François Diallo set his pen and notebook on the table. Thank you, Kirsten said. I'll answer your questions now if you'd like, but only if these ones don't go in your newspaper.
Agreed.
When you think of how the world's changed in your lifetime, what do you think about?
I think of killing.
Her gaze was steady.
Really? Why?
Have you ever had to do it? François sighed. He didn't like to think about it.
I was surprised in the woods once.
I've been surprised, too.
It was evening, and François had lit a candle in the library. It stood in the middle of a plastic tub for safety. The candlelight softened the scar on Kirsten's left cheekbone. She was wearing a summer dress with a faded pattern of white flowers on red, three sheathed knives in her belt.
How many?
He asked. She turned her wrist to show the knife tattoos.
Two.
The symphony had been resting in New Petoskey for a week and a half so far, and François had interviewed almost all of them. August had told him about walking away from his empty house in Massachusetts with his violin, falling in with a cult for 3 years before he walked away again and stumbled across the symphony. Viola had a harrowing story about riding a bicycle west out of the burnt-out ruins of a Connecticut suburb, aged 15, harboring vague notions of California, but set upon by passers-by long before she got there, grievously harmed, joining up with other half-feral teenagers in a marauding gang, and then slipping away from them, walking alone for 100 miles, whispering French to herself, because all the horror in her life had transpired in English, and she thought switching languages might save her, wandering into a town through which the symphony passed 5 years later. The third cello had buried his parents after both died in the absence of insulin, and then spent 4 years holed up in the safety and boredom of their remote cottage on Michigan's Upper Peninsula, set out finally because he feared he'd lose his mind if he didn't find another human being to talk to, also because you can eat only so much venison before you'd give your right arm to eat almost anything else, made his way south and east and over the Mackinac Bridge 10 years before the bridge's center section collapsed, lived on the outskirts of the close-knit band of fishermen in Mackinac City until the symphony passed through. When it came down to it, François had realized, all of the symphony's stories were the same, in two variations. Everyone else died, I walked, I found the symphony. Or, I was very young when it happened, I was born after it happened, I have no memories or few memories of any other way of living, and I have been walking all my life.
Now tell me yours, she said. What do you think about?
When I think of how the world's changed, you mean?
Yes.
My apartment in Paris.
François had been on vacation in Michigan when air travel had ceased. When he closed his eyes, he could still see the intricate moldings of his parlor ceiling, the high white doors leading out to the balcony, the wood floors and books.
Why do you think of killing?
You never had to hurt anyone in the old world, did you?
Of course not. I was a copywriter.
A what?
Advertising. He hadn't thought about it in a long time. You know, billboards and such. Copywriters wrote the words on them.
She nodded, and her gaze drifted away from him. The library was Francois's favorite place in his present life. He had accumulated a sizable collection over the years. Books, magazines, a glass case of pre-collapse newspapers. It had only recently occurred to him to start a newspaper of his own, and thus far the project had been invigorating. Kirsten was looking at the improvised printing press, massive in the shadows at the back of the room.
"How did you get that scar on your face?" he asked.
She shrugged. "I've actually no idea. It happened during that year I don't remember."
"Your brother never told you before he died?"
"He said it was better if I didn't remember. I took his word for it."
"What was he like, your brother?"
"He was sad," she said. "He remembered everything."
"You've never told me what happened to him."
"The kind of stupid death that never would have happened in the old world. He stepped on a nail and died of infection." She glanced up at the window, at the failing light. "I should go," she said. "It's almost sunset."
She stood, and the handles of the knives in her belt glinted in the half-light.
This wire of a woman, polite but lethal, who walked armed with knives through all the days of her life. He'd heard stories from other symphony members about her knife-throwing abilities. She was supposedly able to hit the center of targets blindfolded.
"I thought tonight was just the musicians."
Reluctant, as always, to see her go. "It is, but I told my friends I'd come."
"Thank you for the interview."
He was walking her to the door. "You're welcome."
"If you don't mind me asking, why didn't you want that last part recorded? It isn't the first time I've heard confessions of this nature."
"I know," she said. "Almost everyone in the symphony. But look, I collect celebrity gossip clippings."
"Celebrity gossip?"
"Just about that one actor, Arthur Leander. Because of my collection, the clippings, I understand something about permanent records."
"And it isn't something you want to be remembered for?"
"Exactly," she said. "Are you coming to the performance?"
"Of course. I'll walk with you."
He went back to blow out the candle. The street had fallen into shadow now, but the sky was still bright over the bay. The symphony was performing on a bridge a few blocks from the library, the caravans parked off to the side. Francois heard the first notes, the cacophony of musicians practicing their sections and tuning up. August was playing the same two measures over and over, frowning. Charlie was studying the score. Earlier, a few of the townspeople had carried benches down the hill from the town hall, arranged now in rows facing the bay. Most of the benches were occupied, the adults talking among themselves or watching the musicians, the children spellbound by the instruments. "There's some space in the back row," Kirsten said, and Francois followed her.
"What's the program tonight?"
"A Beethoven symphony. I'm not sure which one." At some undetectable cue, the musicians stopped practicing and tuning and talking among themselves, took their places with their backs to the water, and fell silent. A hush came over the assembled crowd. The conductor stepped forward in the stillness, smiled at the audience and bowed, turned without a word to face the musicians and the bay. A seagull glided overhead. The conductor raised her baton. Chapter 46. That night, in the summer of year 15, Jeevan Chaudhry was drinking wine by a river. The world was a string of settlements now, and the settlements were all that mattered. The land itself no longer had a name, but once this had been part of the state of Virginia. Jeevan had walked 1,000 miles. In year 3, he'd wandered into a settlement called McKinley, named by the town's founders. There had been 8 of them originally, a sales team from the marketing firm of McKinley Stevenson Davies, stranded on an isolated corporate retreat when the Georgia flu swept over the continent. A few days out of the retreat, they'd found an abandoned motel on a disused stretch of road far from major highways.
and it had seemed as good a place to stop as any. The sales team had moved into the rooms and stayed there, at first because those early years were terrifying and no one wanted to live too far from anyone else, later out of habit. There were 27 families here now, a peaceful settlement across the road from a river. In the summer of year 10, Jeevan had married one of the settlement's founders, a former sales assistant named Daria, and this evening she was sitting with him and a friend of theirs on the riverbank.
I don't know, their friend was saying now. Does it still make sense to teach kids about the way things were?
His name was Michael, and he'd been a truck driver once. McKinley had a school, 10 children who met daily in the largest motel room, and his 11-year-old daughter had come home crying that afternoon because the teacher had let slip that life expectancies were much longer before the Georgia flu, that once 60 hadn't been considered particularly old, and she was scared. She didn't understand. It wasn't fair. She wanted to live as long as people used to.
I'm honestly not sure, Daria said. I think I'd want my kid to know. All that knowledge, those incredible things we had.
To what end, though? Michael accepted the wine bottle from her with a nod. You see the way their eyes glaze over when anyone talks to them about antibiotics or engines. It's science fiction to them, isn't it? And if it only upsets them.
He broke off to drink wine.
Maybe you're right, Daria said. I suppose the question is, does knowing these things make them more or less happy? In my daughter's case, less.
Jeevan was only half listening. He wasn't quite drunk, just pleasantly at ease, after what had actually been a fairly ghastly day. A neighbor of theirs had fallen off a ladder that morning, and Jeevan, as the closest thing to a doctor in a 100-mile radius, had had to set the man's broken arm. Horrible work. The patient, drunk on moonshine but still half-crazed with pain, moans escaping around the piece of wood clamped between his teeth. Jeevan liked being the man to whom people turned in bad moments. It meant a great deal to him to be able to help, but the physical pain of the post-anesthesia era often left him shaken. Now fireflies were rising from the tall grass on the riverbank, and he didn't want to talk, not really. But it was pleasant to rest in the company of his friend and his wife, and the wine was blunting the worst of the day's memories, sweat beating on the patient's forehead as Jeevan set the broken bone, as was the gentle music of the river, cicadas in the trees, the stars above the weeping willows on the far bank. Even after all these years, there were moments when he was overcome by his good fortune at having found this place, this tranquility, this woman, at having lived to see a time worth living in. He squeezed Daria's hand.
When she came home crying today, Michael said, I found myself thinking, maybe it's time we stopped telling them these crazy stories. Maybe it's time we let go.
I don't want to let go, Jeevan said.
Is someone calling you? Daria asked.
I hope not, Jeevan said, but then he heard it too.
They followed him back to the motel, where a man had just arrived on horseback, his arm around a woman slumped over in the saddle.
My wife's been shot, he said,
and in the way he spoke, Jeevan understood that he loved her. When they pulled the woman down, she was shivering despite the heat of the evening, half-conscious, her eyelids fluttering. They carried her into the motel room that served as Jeevan's surgery. Michael lit the oil lamps, and the room filled with yellow light.
You're the doctor?
The man who'd brought her asked. He looked familiar, but Jeevan couldn't place him. He was perhaps in his 40s, his hair braided in cornrows that matched his wife's.
Closest thing we've got, Jeevan said.
What's your name?
Edward. Are you saying you're not a real doctor?
I trained as a paramedic before the flu. I apprenticed to a doctor near here for 5 years till he decided to move farther south. I've picked up what I can.
But you didn't go to med school,
Edward said in tones of misery. Well, I'd love to, but I understand they've stopped accepting applications.
I'm sorry.
Edward wiped the sweat from his face with a handkerchief.
I've heard you're good. I mean no offense. She's been shot.
Let me see if I can help.
Jeevan hadn't seen a gunshot wound in some time. By year 15, the ammunition was running low, guns used rarely and only for hunting.
Tell me what happened, he said, mostly to distract Edward.
The Prophet happened.
I don't know who that is.
At least the wound was fairly clean, a hole where the bullet had entered her abdomen, no exit wound. She'd lost some blood. Her pulse was weak but steady.
What Prophet?
I thought the man's legend preceded him, Edward said. He was holding his wife's hand.
He's been all over the South.
I've heard of a dozen prophets over the years. It's not an uncommon occupation.
Jeevan found a bottle of moonshine in the cupboard.
You sterilizing the equipment with that?
I sterilized the needle in boiling water earlier, but I'm going to sterilize it again in this.
The needle? You're sewing her up without getting the bullet out?
Too dangerous, Jeevan said softly. Look, the bleeding's just about stopped. If I go in there looking for it, she might bleed out. Safer to leave it in.
He poured some moonshine into a bowl and rubbed his hands with it, ran needle and thread through the alcohol.
Can I do anything?
Edward was hovering.
The three of you can hold her still while I'm sewing.
So there was a Prophet, he said.
He'd found it best to distract the people who came in with his patients.
He came through this afternoon, Edward said. Him and his followers, maybe 20 of them altogether.
Jeevan remembered where he'd seen Edward before.
You live up in the old plantation, don't you? I went up there with the doctor a few times, back in my apprenticeship days.
Yes, the plantation, exactly.
We're out in the fields, and a friend of mine comes running. Says there's a group of 20 or 22 approaching, walking down the road singing some kind of weird hymn. After a while I hear it too, and eventually they reach us. A group of them, smiling, walking all together in a clump. By the time they reach us, they've stopped singing, and there are fewer of them than I'm expecting, maybe more like 15.
Edward was silent for a moment as Jeevan poured alcohol over the woman's stomach. She moaned, and a thin trickle of blood left the wound.
Keep talking.
So we ask them who they are, and their leader smiles at me and says, "We are the light."
The light?
Jeevan drew the needle through the woman's skin.
Don't look, he said, when Edward swallowed. Just hold her still.
That's when I knew who he was. Stories had reached us from traders and such. These people, they're ruthless. They've got some crazy theology. They're armed and they take what they want. So I'm trying to stay cool. We all are. I can see my neighbors have realized what we're dealing with, too. I ask if there's something they need or if this is just a social call. And the Prophet smiles at me and says they have something we want, and they'd be willing to trade this thing we want for guns and ammunition.
You still have ammo?
Did until today. There was a fair stockpile at the plantation. And as he's talking, I'm looking around, and I realize I don't know where my kid is. He was with his mother, but where's his mother? I ask them, what is it you have that you think we want?
Then what?
Then the group parts down the middle, and there's my son. They've got him. The kid's 5, okay? And they've got him bound and gagged, and I'm terrified now, because where's his mother?
So you gave them the weapons?
We gave them the guns. They gave me my boy. Another group of them had taken my wife. That's why there were 15 there in front of me and not 20. They'd taken her off down the road ahead as a kind of, I don't know, insurance policy?
His voice thick with disgust.
And they tell us if no one comes after them, my wife will come walking down the road in an hour or two, unharmed. They say they're traveling out of the area, headed north, and this is the last we'll see of them. All the time smiling, so peaceful, like they've done nothing wrong. So we get the boy, they leave with the guns and ammo, and we wait. 3 hours later, she still hasn't come down the road, so a few of us go after them, and we find her shot on the roadside.
Why did they do it?
The woman was awake, Jeevan realized. She was crying silently, her eyes closed.
One last stitch.
She said the Prophet wanted her to stay with them, Edward said. Go north with them and become a wife to one of his men, and she said no, so the Prophet shot her. Not to kill her, obviously, at least not quickly,
just to cause her pain.
Jivan clipped the thread and pressed a clean towel to the woman's stomach.
A bandage, he said to Daria, but she was already by his side with strips of an old sheet. He wrapped the woman carefully.
She'll be okay, he said, provided it doesn't get infected, and there's no reason to think it will. Bullets are self-sterilizing, the heat of them. We were careful with the alcohol. But you two should stay here for a few days.
I'm grateful, Edward said. I do what I can.
When he'd cleaned up and the woman had fallen into a fitful sleep, her husband by her side, Jivan put the bloody needle in a saucepan and crossed the road to the river. He knelt in the grass to fill the pan with water and returned to the motel, where he lit the makeshift oven in front of the room he lived in and set the saucepan on top of it. He sat on a nearby picnic table to wait for the water to boil. Jivan filled a pipe with tobacco from his shirt pocket, a soothing ritual, trying to think of nothing but the stars and the sound of the river, trying not to think about the woman's pain and her blood, and the kind of people who would shoot out of spite and leave her lying there on the roadside. McKinley was south of the old plantation. If the prophet was true to his word, then he and his people were moving away from McKinley, headed into the unsuspecting north. Why north? Jivan wondered. And how far would they go? He was thinking of Toronto, of walking through snow. Thoughts of Toronto led inevitably back to thoughts of his brother, a tower by the lake, Ghost City crumbling, the Elgin and Winter Garden Theater Center still displaying the posters for King Lear, the memory of that night at the beginning and the end of everything, when Arthur died. Daria had come up behind him. He started when she touched his arm. The water was boiling, and had been for some time, the needle probably sterile by now. Daria took his hand in her own and kissed it gently.
It's late, she murmured. Come to bed.
Chapter 47 Clark at 70, in year 19. He was more tired than he had been, and he moved slowly. His joints and hands ached, especially in cold weather. He shaved his entire head now, not just the left side, and wore four rings through his left ear. His dear friend Annette had died of an unknown illness in year 17, and he wore her Lufthansa neck scarf in memory. He wasn't specifically sad anymore, but he was aware of death at all times. There was an armchair in the museum from which he could see almost the entire tarmac, the preparation area where the hunters hung their deer and boar and rabbits from a rack improvised on the underside of the wing of a 737, carving meat for the people and feeding innards to the dogs. The graveyard between runways 6 and 7, each grave marked by an airplane tray table driven into the ground, details of the deceased carved into the tray's hard plastic. He'd left some wildflowers on Annette's grave that morning, and he could see them from here, a splash of blue and purple. The line of jets parked end to end on the periphery, streaked now with rust. The gardens, half hidden from view by the airplanes parked at gates. The cornfield, Air Gradia 452 alone in the distance. The chain-link perimeter fence with its coils of concertina wire, and beyond that the forest, the same trees he'd been staring at for 2 decades. He'd recently made all of the Water, Inc. 360-degree reports available for public viewing, on the theory that everyone involved was almost certainly dead. The former executives in the airport read these with great interest. There were 3 reports altogether, one each for the subordinates, peers, and superiors of a probably long-deceased Water, Inc. executive named Dan. Okay, take this, for example, Garrett said on one of their afternoons in the airport, late July. They'd become close friends over the years. Garrett found the reports particularly fascinating. You have the heading here, communication, and then... Which report are you looking at? Clark was sunk deep into his favorite armchair, eyes closed. Subordinates,
Garrett said. Okay, so under communication, here's the first comment. He's not good at cascading information down to staff. Was he a whitewater rafter, Clark? I'm just curious.
Yes, Clark said. I'm certain that's what the interviewee was talking about. Actual, literal cascades.
This one's my other favorite. He's successful in interfacing with clients we already have, but as for new clients, it's low-hanging fruit. He takes a high-altitude view, but he doesn't drill down to that level of granularity where we might actionize new opportunities.
Clark winced. I remember that one. I think I may have had a minor stroke in the office when he said that.
It raises questions, Garrett said. It certainly does. There are high altitudes, apparently, also low-hanging fruit, also grains of something, also drilling. Presumably, he was a miner who climbed mountains and actionized an orchard in his off-hours. I am proud to say, Clark said, that I never talked like that.
Did you ever use the phrase, in the mix?
I don't think so. No, I wouldn't have. I hated that one especially.
Garrett was studying the report.
Oh, I didn't mind it so much. It made me think of baking. My mother would buy these cookie mixes sometimes when I was a kid.
Do you remember chocolate chip cookies?
I dream of chocolate chip cookies. Don't torture me.
Garrett was quiet for so long that Clark opened his eyes to make sure he was still breathing. Garrett was absorbed in watching two children playing on the tarmac, hiding behind the wheels of the Air Canada jet and chasing one another. He'd become calmer over the years, but remained prone to episodes of unfocused staring, and Clark knew by now what his next question would be.
"Did I ever tell you about my last phone call?" Garrett asked.
"Yes," Clark said gently. "I believe you did." Garrett had had a wife and 4-year-old twins in Halifax, but the last call he'd ever made was to his boss. The last words he'd spoken into a telephone were a bouquet of corporate cliches, seared horribly into memory.
"Let's touch base with Nancy," he remembered saying, "and then we should reach out to Bob and circle back next week. I'll shoot Larry an email."
Now he said the words, "circle back next week," under his breath, perhaps not consciously. He cleared his throat.
"Why did we always say we were going to shoot emails?"
"I don't know. I've wondered that, too.
Why couldn't we just say we were going to send them? We were just pressing a button, were we not?"
"Not even a real button. A picture of a button on a screen."
"Yes," Garrett said. "That's exactly what I'm talking about."
There was not, in fact, an email gun, although that would have been nice. I would have preferred that.
Garrett made his fingers into a gun and aimed it at the tree line.
"Kapow," he whispered, and then louder. "I used to write THX when I wanted to say thank you."
"I did that too."
"Because what? It would have taken too much time and effort to punch in an extra 3 letters and just say thanks? I can't fathom it."
The phrase circle back always secretly made me think of boats. You leave someone on shore, and then you circle back later to get them.
Garrett was quiet for a moment.
"Huh, I like this one," he said. "He's a high-functioning sleepwalker, essentially."
"I remember the woman who said that." Clark wondered what had happened to her. He'd been spending more time in the past lately. He liked to close his eyes and let his memories overtake him. A life remembered is a series of photographs and disconnected short films. The school play when he was 9, his father beaming in the front row. Clubbing with Arthur in Toronto under whirling lights. A lecture hall at NYU. An executive, a client, running his hands through his hair as he talked about his terrible boss. A procession of lovers remembered in details. A set of dark blue sheets. A perfect cup of tea. A pair of sunglasses. A smile. The Brazilian pepper tree in a friend's backyard in Silver Lake. A bouquet of tiger lilies on a desk. Robert's smile. his mother's hands knitting while she listened to the BBC. He woke to quiet voices. This had been happening more and more lately, this nodding off unexpectedly, and it left him with an unsettled intimation of rehearsal. You fall asleep for short periods, and then for longer periods, and then forever. He straightened in the armchair, blinking. Garrett was gone. The last light of the day angled in through the glass and caught the chrome perfection of the motorcycle.
"Did I wake you?"
Sullivan asked. He was the head of security, a man of 50 who'd walked in a decade earlier with his daughter.
"I'd like to introduce you to our latest arrivals."
"How do you do?" Clark said. The arrivals were a man and a woman, perhaps in their early 30s, the woman carrying a baby in a sling. "I'm Charlie," the woman said. "This is Jeremy, my husband, and little Annabel." Tattoos covered almost every inch of her bare arms. He saw flowers, musical notes, names in an elaborate scroll, a rabbit. Four knives tattooed in a row on her right forearm. He knew what this tattoo meant, and when he looked, he saw a counterpart on her husband's skin, two small dark arrows on the back of his left wrist. She'd killed four people then, and he'd killed two, and now they'd just dropped in with their baby. And by the absurd standards of the new world, there was a part of him that never stopped exclaiming at the absurd standards of the new world, this was all perfectly normal. The baby smiled at Clark. Clark smiled back.
"Will you be staying here a while?" Clark asked. "If you'll have us," Jeremy said. "We've been separated from our people."
"Wait till you hear who their people are," Sullivan said. "You remember those newspapers out of New Petoskey?"
"The Traveling Symphony," Charlie said.
"These people of yours."
Sullivan was wiggling his fingers at the baby Annabel, who stared past his fingers at his face.
"You didn't tell me how you lost them."
"It's a complicated story," Charlie said. "There was a prophet. He said he was from here." From here? Had the airport ever had a prophet? Clark felt certain he'd remember a prophet.
"What was his name?"
"I'm not sure anyone knows," Jeremy said. He began describing the blonde-haired man who had held sway over the town of St. Deborah-by-the-Water, ruling with a combination of charisma, violence, and cherry-picked verses from the Book of Revelation. He stopped when he saw the look on Clark's face.
"Is something wrong?"
Clark rose unsteadily from the armchair. They stared at him as he made his way to the museum's first display case.
"Is his mother still alive?"
Clark was looking at Elizabeth's passport, at its photograph from the inconceivable past.
"Whose mother? The prophet's?"
"Yes."
"I don't think so," Charlie said. "I never heard anything about her."
"There's no old woman there with him?"
"No."
"What became of you, Elizabeth? Out there on the road with your son." But what, after all, had become of anyone? His parents, his colleagues, all his friends from his life before the airport. Robert. If all of them had vanished, uncounted and unmarked, why not Elizabeth, too? He closed his eyes, thinking of a boy standing on the tarmac by the ghost plane, Air Gradia Flight 452, Arthur Leander's beloved only son, reading verses about plagues aloud to the dead. Part 8. The Prophet. Chapter 48. 3 days after Kirsten and August became separated from the symphony, behind a garden shed in an overgrown backyard on the outskirts of Severn City, Kirsten woke abruptly with tears in her eyes. She'd dreamt that she'd been walking down the road with August, then she turned and he was gone, and she knew he was dead. She'd screamed his name, she'd run down the road, but he was nowhere. When she woke, he was watching her, his hand on her arm. "I'm right here," he said. She must have said his name aloud. "It's nothing, just a bad dream." "I had bad dreams, too."
He was holding his silver Starship Enterprise in his other hand. It wasn't quite morning. The sky was brightening, but night lingered below in the shadows, gray light, dewdrops suspended in the grass.